From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Apocalypse Now, a new edition of the film with digital sound has just come out on home video. Hearts of Darkness, a documentary on the making of Apocalypse Now, will be released next week on home video. We'll talk with Eleanor Coppola about shooting documentary footage behind the scenes of her husband's film. And we'll talk with actor Larry Fishburne about his experiences as an impressionable teenager working in the jungle with Marlon Brando and Dennis Hopper. Fishburne, who played the young soldier in The Boat, went on to star as the father in Boys in the Hood and just won a Tony for Best Actor for his performance in Two Trains Running. Also today, Stephen Schiff reviews the new suspense film Unlawful Entry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Navy Secretary Lawrence Garrett announced today that he's resigning over incidents of sexual abuse at a convention of Navy and Marine Corps flyers last year. Garrett said he accepted responsibility for a leadership failure that tolerated the sexual assault of 26 women, half of whom were naval officers. The secretary was at last year's convention of the Tailhook Association in Las Vegas, but he said he neither saw nor engaged in any offensive conduct. The Supreme Court ruled today that airports may bar religious and political groups from soliciting donations in airport terminals. The court said, however, airports may not bar the same groups from leafleting in the terminal. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The court's ruling came in a test case brought by the Hare Krishna religious sect, which, as part of its religion, requires its followers to solicit donations. In recent years, the Hare Krishnas have stationed themselves at almost every airport in America, but today the Supreme Court said that an airport is not a public forum and that solicitation can be banned. The vote was 6-3, with Chief Justice William Rehnquist writing an opinion declaring that face-to-face solicitation presents risks of duress that are an appropriate target of regulation. A separate coalition of justices, however, concluded that leafleting is permissible. That vote was 5-4. In fact, the ruling in the case was so fractured that Justice O'Connor, in announcing it from the bench, drew a laugh from the courtroom crowd when she concluded, "Now, if anyone can figure that out, they're doing well." I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
National Organization for Women President Patricia Ireland says if the Supreme Court moves to weaken Roe v. Wade next week, then women will have to take their fight for abortion rights to Congress. Ireland made her comments during the opening session of a Now conference being held in Chicago. Cheryl Corley of member station WBEZ reports.
Ireland says electing more women to office will serve the national interest, since women are leaders in pushing for health care, civil rights, and abortion rights. Ireland says the most clear example of the need for more women in office was when Congress failed to override President Bush's veto of the gag rule, a rule which does not allow information about abortion to be released at federally funded clinics.
96% of the women in Congress, across party lines, voted to override the veto. But with only 5% of us there, we simply were not great enough in number to make the difference.
The president of NOW says they will build on the primary victories of women candidates in Pennsylvania, Illinois, and California to recruit others. For National Public Radio, I'm Cheryl Corley in Chicago.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 2 points to close at 3,282.4. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali appears to be preparing for new UN action in Bosnia. The secretary said that Serbian forces will face unspecified consequences if they don't stop their offensive in Sarajevo within 48 hours. Some world leaders have suggested that UN forces open a corridor so that relief supplies can be brought in by convoy, but so far the Security Council has given no mandate for any military action. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney told Congress this morning that the administration intends to continue nuclear testing as long as the United States maintains a stockpile of nuclear weapons. The statement came in testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Secretary Cheney said there is no alternative to testing on grounds of both safety and reliability. Most U.S. tests, he said, have a yield of less than 35 kilotons, far below the 150-kiloton threshold limit, and the secretary said the nuclear stockpile is safer with testing than without. Secretary Cheney and General Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, were appearing to testify in favor of the START agreement to cut the nuclear forces of the U.S. and the successor states of the Soviet Union. Both said it was important to ratify this treaty as soon as possible. Some want to wait for the new agreement on much deeper cuts that was reached during Russian President Boris Yeltsin's visit earlier this month to be reduced to treaty language and consider both treaties at the same time. Cheney and Powell said prompt ratification of START was important on political and military grounds. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Delegates from the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan emerged from negotiations in Washington today with a grudging acknowledgement that they'd made some progress in peace talks. The two countries are fighting over Nagorno-Karabakh. Representatives from both sides said that they haven't come up with a compromise, but that they agreed that the fighting must be stopped. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new edition of Apocalypse Now has just come out on home video. It's letterboxed, and it has digital sound. Larry Fishburne was a teenager when he played the role of the young soldier in the boat with Martin Sheen. We're going to hear an interview I recorded with him a few months ago in which he reminisced about the making of the film as well as a few other subjects. Fishburne just won a Tony Award for Best Actor for his performance in August Wilson's play Two Trains Running. Last year, he played the father in the film Boys in the Hood. He starred in Spike Lee's film School Days and played Cowboy Curtis on Pee-wee's Playhouse. Fishburne started acting when he was 10 years old, and he had a featured part on the soap opera One Life to Live. 2 years later, he co-starred in the movie Cornbread Earl and Me. In his latest film, Deep Cover, he played an undercover cop posing as a drug dealer. Fishburne is the son of a corrections officer, so I wanted to know if that affected his attitude toward cops when he was growing up.
Not so much my attitude towards cops as it was my attitude toward the possibility of winding up in jail.
Right.
I knew that wasn't a place I wanted to go. My father would often come to me with messages from the young inmates that he was in charge of. And the one message that kept coming to me was that if I ever messed up and wound up in jail, that they would take care of me. So I knew that was a place I didn't want to go.
Did a lot of people assume after Boys in the Hood, in which you played the father, did a lot of people assume that you only wanted to play positive role models after that?
I'm sure a lot of people do think that. I think that there's a need for all that kind of stuff and positive role models and the like, but I have to do things for me, and you know, we're all not positive role models, you know? And I think my responsibility is to reflect truth wherever I see it, and the truth is not always a positive role model, you know.
I think probably the most interesting roles are also probably not positive role models.
Yeah, the you know, some of the most fun are not the role model guys. Absolutely.
A good example is your role in King of New York.
Which I'm very, very proud of.
Yeah, yeah. And you were, you know, a big drug dealer in that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, he wasn't even a drug dealer. I mean,
just controlled vice.
Christopher Walken's character deals drugs. My character kills people.
Right, okay.
You know,
yeah,
and,
right.
And it's the kind of character you see in the movies all the time. For me, he's a classic two-gun kid. The role was written for a white actor, and we get to see white actors occasionally, or more than occasionally, often in movies, run around with two pistols, shooting people, laughing about it, having a good time, and going off scot-free. It's a classic movie type, and it's something I've always wanted to do. I had to campaign very hard to win that role, and I did, and I'm very proud of the work because, you know, I was able to do something that people, because of their color, aren't allowed to do, you know?
You know, I usually hear the opposite complaint from African-American actors, that they have to, that they're tired of being offered the roles of the killers, and you really
right.
went
well,
after this one.
Yeah, I wasn't even offered it. You see, that was the whole that was the whole problem, you know? They offered me the cop that Wesley Snipes played in that movie, which would have been fun, but I think Jump was a lot more fun. And, you know, there's a lot of young cats who see the movie who really enjoy it. Not just young people, but, you know, older people, too, who really enjoy the movie. So I'm really proud of that. I'm just as proud of that as I am of Furious.
The father
mm-hmm.
in
the father
in Boys
in the
Hood.
Hood. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Larry Fishburne. You started acting as a child. I think you had your first big role when you were 10. Did you want to act, or was it more your parents' suggestion?
I wanted to be a doctor. Right. And then I wanted to be a basketball player.
Uh-huh.
But by that time, I was 9. And I got my first role professionally when I was 10. I had been doing, you know, plays in school and stuff. You know, from the age of 3, I guess. So the acting came to me naturally, as it does to most children, because children are the best actors. And from the age of 10, after getting my first job, it just kind of creeped along and built, you know, and kept building and building and building until, you know, here I am 20 years later.
How did you get, what kind of part did you have on One Life to Live, the soap opera, when you were 10?
I was a young orphan, kind of living by his wits on the street, who was found by this police officer breaking into his into his office. And I subsequently got adopted by two black characters who had been romantically involved with one another on this show for many years, and we sort of became the first African-American family on television. Or at least on a soap opera, daytime television, anyway.
That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So did you enjoy it? Did it feel like work or fun?
It felt like fun. I mean, I got to miss school 1 or 2 days out of the week. I got paid a little bit of money.
Did your parents let you keep the money that you earned?
No, that money was put away.
For your college?
Yeah, well, I never went to college, so, you know. But, yeah.
You went to Apocalypse Now.
Yeah,
instead.
I went to Apocalypse Now school. Right.
We'll get to that a little bit later.
Sure.
When you started acting as a kid, was your mother with you, or, you know, behind you when you were getting roles
sure.
as a kid?
Sure, she was very much behind me. She was very supportive. In fact, you might even say she was a bit pushy at times.
What would she do when she was pushy?
Well, she would. The pushy stuff was like, there'd be auditions for, you know, for musicals and stuff like that, you know, and for really, really commercial kind of things. And even at a very young age, I was not interested in doing very, very commercial things, you know? Not very interested in doing the thing that was going to be popular just based on the material itself, you know? So those kind of things I would resist a lot.
But she'd try to push you into doing them?
Yeah, she'd try and push me into them, and I'd be like, no, I don't think so. I'm not going to do that.
Any big hits that you talked your way out of?
Let's see now. Well, there was a play that was called The Me Nobody Knows.
Oh, I remember that.
That I was like, nah, I don't think I want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, a few things. I can't remember.
When you were 12, you starred in Cornbread, Earl and Me,
right.
which I never saw. I don't even know what it's about, to tell you the truth.
Oh, it's a great little movie.
After making Cornbread, Earl and Me, were you a celebrity in your neighborhood?
I guess I was, yeah. I remember when I was a kid, people used to call me Movie Star a lot. And they'd say, hey, Movie Star, how come you dress like a bum?
Were you kind of a bohemian when you were young?
Yeah, I've been a bohemian all my life. John Singleton really, really hit it on the head. John was like, people are like this and that. And John looks at me and goes, Fish is a hippie, man. He's a hippie. You know, so.
Did people in the neighborhood think you should be wearing your money?
Yeah. Yeah, especially the kids.
My guest is Larry Fishburne. He just won a Tony Award for Best Actor for his performance in August Wilson's play, Two Trains Running. Fishburne starred in the films Deep Cover, Boys in the Hood, and School Days. In Apocalypse Now, he was the young soldier in Martin Sheen's boat. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Actor Larry Fishburne is my guest. The movie Apocalypse Now broke the hearts and souls of grown men who were in it. Mm. You were 15 when you were cast in that film. You were like the kid in the boat taking Martin Sheen down the river. Your mother came with you to the Philippines to shoot the movie, right? How did your father feel? I mean, I'm sure you were expecting to be there for a few months. The movie took, I think, more than 2 years to
Yeah, we were told we were going to be there for 3 months. And we wound up staying the better part of 2 years, 76 and 77.
So the family was divided for that period of time.
Well, you know, the family really, the family unit was my mother and myself. My mother and my father were, you know, divorced when I was very young. So I pretty much grew up with my mother. My father did, though, come over and spend a great deal of time with me. And it was actually for the first time in my life that my father and I lived together was when I was over there. And that was really nice. It was very, very, very nice. So we were actually kind of together rather than that we were divided towards the end of the shooting. I think the last 6 months of the shooting, my father was there with my mother and I and my mother's new husband because she had remarried. So,
how did it feel? Here you were working with Marlon Brando and Dennis Hopper and Robert Duvall, and you're there with your mom, you know? Did you feel like, Mom, go home?
No, I mean, my mother was a teacher and is a very creative person herself. So she really let me go. I mean, to a large extent. I mean, in that environment, she recognized that her son was now, you know, 6 inches taller than her and was involved in this, you know, pretty serious undertaking. So she didn't try and restrain me in any way. She really let me go.
I'm sure there were a lot of, I mean, I'm guessing, I imagine that there were a lot of drugs on the set, a lot of marijuana and maybe LSD. So when your father was down there, him being a, you know, corrections officer, law enforcement guy, did he turn his head the other way?
Well, no, he didn't. He didn't, not at all. In fact, that was the reason that he came down.
Oh,
because
to keep you straight?
Yeah, really, to keep me straight. Because my mother, like I said, she let me go and she couldn't get me back. So she called in the big guns.
So what did he do?
He followed me around everywhere I went, and he carried a big stick. You think I'm kidding?
He really did carry a stick?
He really did.
Did he use it on you?
No. My father's psychological. Psychological. My father's a very big man. He's very big.
Well, did he use that kind of psychological stuff on Dennis Hopper?
No, he didn't have to. He wasn't there for Dennis Hopper. He was there for me. So, it worked.
It did?
It worked.
Yeah. Were you afraid?
Oh, yeah.
What was it like to be 15 years old and working with actors like Marlon Brando and Dennis Hopper, who seemed to have kind of flipped, you know? I saw the movie Hearts of Darkness about the making of Apocalypse Now, and as extraordinary Brando and Hopper are as actors, they seemed like they were so difficult to work with. And so here you were watching these like two great actors behaving bizarrely.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Fortunately for me, my character is dead by the time we get to see those two guys. So I didn't have to work with them in that way. But as far as behavior, I had never seen anybody behaved the way Dennis Hopper did. And I think we all know that no one behaves the way that Brando does other than Brando. So it was very interesting. And it was, I mean, I was very impressionable, 14, 15. I had never heard of Dennis Hopper. But when I saw him, I had never seen a human being behave that way. And I was like, this is the guy. This is the cat. Forget about Brando. Forget about Sheen. This is the man. I want to be like this man. Because he was just out. You know, he was in a continual state of chaos. He was just amazing to watch. And those were not his best days.
Right.
But in order for him to get where he is, he had to go through that. So, you know, I was very impressed. The whole experience, because I was so young, you see, to me, all of that was normal. It was only my second film. So I came back from that experience thinking, okay, well, this is the way you make movies. You have too much money, you have too much time, and you go completely crazy while you do it.
So how did you change when you tried to model yourself on Dennis Hopper?
Oh, well, you know, I tried to drink as much as I can and smoke as much reefer as I can and listen to as much loud music as I can, that kind of stuff.
Your father must have been thrilled.
He was. He was. Well, see, that's why he had to carry a big stick.
Right. So what got you out of that period?
I came home. I came home and I had to go to high school. You know, I had to, like, finish high school, you know.
God, going to high school after making Apocalypse Now, that must have been
something. It was a joke. It really was. It was quite funny. But Francis was, you know, Francis was cool. He understood what he had done, you know.
What was the most, I'm sorry, go ahead.
He understood where he had kind of dropped me and what kind of environment he had dropped me in. So I went to go stay with him. He opened a school for gifted youngsters. Actually, the school he called, he said, for kids who want to rule the world. And it was me and his son, and Giancarlo, who has passed away in 86. God bless him. And Mickey Hart's son and some other kids. So we ran around and we were like assistants to all these other people who were doing great things. You know, like I was Wim Wenders' assistant for a while.
Huh.
Which meant I went and got the pizza and the cigars and cleaned up after they had, you know, readings and stuff.
So that's the high school you went to, or did you go to real high school after
that? Well, I went to real high school after that, but, you know, sort of in between going to real high school and graduating, I went to go to this kid, you know, to the school for kids who want to rule the world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Larry Fishburne. Now, you were a regular on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
You betcha.
You were there you go. You were Cowboy Curtis.
Yes, ma'am. Ooh-wee.
And you had a great animated lasso.
Yes. Magic lasso.
Yeah. How'd you get the part with Pee-wee?
I met Pee-wee in L.A. Back in the early 80s. And he and I became friends, and I was doing Gardens of Stone, and I got this call. He said, I need a black cowboy. So I said, no problem, you know, and I saddled up and rode on in. Kind of where it's at.
Was it fun to work on the show?
It was wonderful.
Love that show.
I mean, it was the first, you know, television show for children that had live people on it for a long time.
Now, you've made two movies with Spike Lee.
Made one with him.
One movie? Mm-hmm. Gee, why am I thinking it's two? It was School Days. What was I thinking of the second?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Was it Do the Right Thing?
No, I know you're not in that.
Mm-hmm.
You were asked to be in that.
I was asked to play Radio Raheem.
Yeah, but you turned it down.
Right.
How come?
I didn't like the part.
Yeah, tell me what you didn't like about it.
Well, I didn't like the script. I grew up in Brooklyn, too. And Radio Raheem, to me, wasn't well-developed as a character. He wasn't defined on the page. And that meant that I had to bring all the stuff to make him human to it. And I felt like I had done enough of that in terms of what I did in School Days for the character of Dap. The problem that I have with Spike's work is that he doesn't do as much rewriting as he could, and he leaves it to the actors to sort of fill in the blanks, which is nice. It's nice to have that kind of freedom. But at the same time, if you're allowed that kind of freedom and the director won't let you in on what his vision is, it's kind of difficult to know what to do. Spike has a ceiling that you can't see about how far he'll let you go. He welcomes your input and he welcomes your improvisation, but to a point. So it's difficult to know how far to go because he won't tell you where, you know, how far you can go. And when things are well defined on the page, then you know how far to go. with Do the Right Thing, we got a script that I think was about 98 to 109 pages, with a character who had no dialogue, who was basically a device to create this big race riot scene at the end. And I'm not really kind of into race riots. I don't think they help anybody, so I passed.
Could you work with Spike Lee after turning down one of his roles?
Could I work with him?
Could you work with him again after that?
That's up to him.
Mm-hmm. Would you want to?
If the material was really good and, you know, if it was something I was interested in doing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you worked with John Singleton on Boys in the Hood.
Right.
I understand he was a production assistant on Pee-wee's Playhouse, and that's
you
how you
bet
met?
You.
Right, it's Cowboy Curtis again.
Yeah.
So that was the first script he wrote. Was that well fleshed out?
Very well. It's airtight, watertight. You know, I mean, he wrote it in school, in this dramatic writing program. He won an award for it. He went back and wrote it again, re-entered in the same contest and won the same award again 2 years in a row. He had thought about it for 4 years before he wrote it.
Was there anything about Furious, the father that you played in Boys in the Hood, that reminded you of your own father?
not until I saw the movie a couple of times did I see my father in my performance.
Uh-huh. What was it in your performance that reminded you of him?
There was just there's just a look. There's a way that I hold my face in one particular scene that I went, oh, there's my dad, you know?
Is your mother really pleased with the way your career's turned out? You know, I think of all the child actors I've seen on Entertainment Tonight and all those shows talking mm-hmm. about how they have to be in self-help groups because their lives were so troubled and tragic mm-hmm. after the TV series stopped or whatever.
Right,
and
right.
You've gone on to a real serious, interesting, fine career.
Well, that was the other thing that my mother wanted me to do was be in a series, and that was the thing that, you know, I resisted.
Huh.
And I think it's because of that resistance that I've been able to survive. And, you know, have a career as an adult.
Right.
You know, so I hope my mother is pleased.
Larry Fishburne, thanks a lot for talking with us.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Actor Larry Fishburne. You can see the young Larry Fishburne in a new print of Apocalypse Now, which has just come out on home video. It's letterboxed with digital sound. Fishburne also starred in Boys in the Hood and School Days. He's currently on Broadway in August Wilson's play Two Trains Running. He recently won a Tony for Best Actor. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During the filming of Apocalypse Now, Eleanor Coppola accused her husband of creating his own Vietnam. She should know. She was on the set making a documentary about the epic her husband was directing. Now you can see her footage in the movie Hearts of Darkness. It's about to come out on home video. Coming up, Eleanor Coppola on the making of Apocalypse Now. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new suspense movie, Unlawful Entry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Navy Secretary Lawrence Garrett has resigned, saying that he accepted responsibility for what he termed a leadership failure in connection with the so-called tailhook incident. At a 1991 Naval Flyers Convention in Las Vegas, 26 women charged that they were sexually assaulted by Navy and Marine Corps pilots. Garrett was in Los Angeles at that convention, but said that he did not see or engage in any offensive conduct. He had come under fire in the wake of a Navy investigation, which said that senior naval officers had known for years of events at the convention, but had done nothing to prevent it. UN Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali says that conditions in the Bosnian capital of Sarajevo have deteriorated greatly. He said today, unless fighting stops, the UN may reconsider its plan to send peacekeepers to the airport to help with relief supplies. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Boutros-Ghali said Serb forces have increased their bombardment of Dobrinja, a suburb of Sarajevo. He said despite ceasefire agreements, there have been heavy tank and infantry attacks on civilians, and government forces have retaliated with assaults on Serb areas. Unless the shelling stops, he said, and Serbs agree to move their heavy weapons within 48 hours, the UN will abandon its plans to secure the airport to distribute relief supplies. If that happens, he said, the Security Council will have to decide what to do next, and some UN officials say they are not sure what the Council could do to control the situation, short of authorizing military action against Serb forces. Meanwhile, a UN report has recommended increasing the UN's mandate in Croatia because of tensions in disputed areas. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court said today that Mississippi has not done enough to overcome the remnants of segregation at institutions of higher learning. The ruling could have a far-reaching impact on the future of all historically black public colleges and universities. NPR's David Mopus reports.
Even though Mississippi has race-neutral admission policies, allowing blacks and whites to attend the college of their choice, the colleges remain largely segregated, and the black campuses continue to be underfunded. That, the court said, constitutes perpetuation of an unconstitutional dual system of education, which must be dismantled. The 8-1 ruling overturns lower court decisions and opens the door for blacks to seek more equality in funding and distribution of academic programs at the state's three historically black colleges. Black educators throughout the country view the decision as a major victory, but some remain concerned that states like Mississippi might move to close some black colleges in the name of desegregation. Justice Antonin Scalia, the lone dissenter in the case, predicts years of additional litigation. I'm David Malpas reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 1.5 points to close at 3,282.41. This is NPR News. In Israel, labor leader Yitzhak Rabin says that he will try and have a more flexible approach in Middle Eastern peace talks and, in his words, put new content into them. He spoke at a news conference today in the wake of official election results that confirmed his party's election victory earlier this week. Rabin also said that he will cut what he termed tremendous incentives offered to Israelis to settle in occupied territory and cut back on construction of settlements. Texas Governor Ann Richards announced today that she will chair the Democratic Convention in New York City next month. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Ann Richards, the silver-haired, silver-tongued first-term governor, is best known nationally for her tart keynote address at the Democratic Convention 4 years ago. Of the GOP presidential candidate, she said, "Poor George, he can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth." Today, Richards indicated that her leadership of next month's convention will be more subdued. My number one goal is to run an efficient and well-ordered convention, she said, and I'll take that responsibility very seriously. Richards said several months ago she did not want the high-profile chairwoman's job, but she said today she changed her mind when asked by Democratic Party Chairman Ron Brown. Among her duties, Richards will deliver opening remarks, begin the evening sessions, and direct activities at the podium. The keynote speakers will be former Texas Congresswoman Barbara Jordan, Georgia Governor Zell Miller, and New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley. In Austin, I'm John Burnett reporting.
Amnesty International says for several years now, police in Los Angeles have used excessive force. The human rights group said in most cases, officers involved in using excessive force received only minor sanctions. A spokesman for the group called the record on police brutality in Los Angeles appalling. Amnesty said that police brutality has gone unchecked there for years, with officers feeling free to act without fear of discipline or prosecution. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The makers of the 1979 Vietnam epic, Apocalypse Now, were said to have run into some of the same problems that faced the men who fought the war. Once they got in, they got deeper and deeper and couldn't pull themselves out. The documentary Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, shows how director Francis Ford Coppola dealt with recreating jungle warfare in the Philippines during a real civil war. There were times Coppola was sure he could not make a movie out of his increasingly incoherent footage.
What I have to admit is that I don't know what I'm doing.
How do you account for the discrepancy between what you feel about it and what everybody else who sees it?
Because they see the magic of what has happened before. I'm saying, hey, it's not going to happen. I don't have any performances. The script doesn't make sense. I have no ending. I'm like a voice crying out, saying, please, it's not working. Somebody get me off this. And nobody listens to me. Everyone says, yes, well, Francis works best in a crisis. I'm saying this is one crisis I'm not going to pull myself out of. I'm making a bad movie, so why should I go ahead? I'm going to be bankrupt anyway. Why can't I just have the courage to say it's no good?
The documentary footage shot during the making of Apocalypse Now was directed by Eleanor Coppola, Francis's wife, at his request. It sat on a shelf until a couple of years ago when two young producers asked to use the footage. They added new interviews with the filmmakers and actors. Their documentary, Hearts of Darkness, comes out Tuesday on home video. Last winter, when it opened theatrically, I spoke with Eleanor Coppola. Her journal, Notes on the Making of Apocalypse Now, was recently published in a new edition. During the filming of Apocalypse Now, Francis orchestrated spectacular recreations of the American bombing of Vietnam. I wondered what it felt like to be in the middle of a phony war.
Well, I found it really exhilarating. You know, it's like the most incredible 4th of July kind of a light show with these, you know, enormous explosions, and the earth shook like an earthquake. They were huge, particularly the napalm attack, and the scene with Colonel Kilgore, Robert Duvall, was just a powerful event to be there. It was just your whole body felt the concussion and this enormous, you know, whatever it was, 10,000 gallons of fuel was lit and exploded in the jungle. And I really found it extraordinary. And I think sometimes that even annoyed Francis that he was trying to get his work done and everybody else was kind of at a light show.
One of the stories that the movie gets into, the documentary on the making of Apocalypse Now, is how Francis Coppola used helicopters from the Philippine Army because the United States Army wouldn't cooperate with the making of a movie about Vietnam. But the government kept wanting the helicopters back to fight a civil war against communist insurgents. Tell us some of the ways that kept disrupting the shooting of Apocalypse Now.
It was a very disruptive situation because the Army would send out their helicopters and whatever pilots they wanted to send out, and the pilots would be different every day, so they hadn't rehearsed. They didn't realize what it was like to fly in through filming situations, and they would sometimes they'd fly too high and they wouldn't be in the camera shot, or they just wouldn't realize what was involved in really performing for the camera, so to speak, so they would lose many, many, many shots because the pilots wouldn't be flying in the right place to be seen in the camera. And then the next day, by the time they finally learned how to do it, the next day they'd send different pilots. And then very frequently they would call the planes away. They'd be all set up for a shot. Everyone would be out there on the location shooting, and they would get some radio communication that that four of the helicopters had to leave for military reasons, or some days all of the helicopters, or some days they would be out there ready to work and expecting eight helicopters to be provided, and only two would show up. So it was a very difficult part of the production, and it cost tens and tens of thousands of dollars in lost footage and waiting for the helicopters to come that never came.
And there were guards at your house because Marcos was afraid that rebels would kidnap you and Francis Coppola for publicity?
Yes, they had some idea that if Francis would be kidnapped for some political reasons by the insurgents, that it would create an international incident and bring attention to the Philippines and unwanted attention, so that they provided us right from the beginning with guards, personal bodyguards. I actually felt more concerned finally that the guards might cause some accident. They got very casual about their weapons. Our main bodyguard had just would stick his pistol in his belt of his blue jeans, and he'd get it out and show the kids how it worked. And he had a trunk full of shotguns and other guns and things in the trunk of the car. And it just seemed like I was really in more danger of some accident from the bodyguards than I really was in danger from insurgents.
I could see how that would not be very reassuring.
No, and I'm there with three children, and yeah. In the casualness of the weapons that the guards had was really a concern to me.
My guest is Eleanor Coppola. She shot a lot of behind-the-scenes documentary footage during the making of Apocalypse Now. That footage has been made into a documentary film called Hearts of Darkness. It comes out on home video next week. There's also a new edition of her book, The Making of Apocalypse Now. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eleanor Coppola, and we're talking about the making of Apocalypse Now. When Marlon Brando arrived on the set to play Kurtz, Francis Coppola didn't realize that Brando was going to be as heavy as he was. How did that affect the way the role was conceived?
Well, when Francis realized that he was not slimmed down and able to play the Green Beret that he was originally, committed to the part for, that Francis had to decide what to do in the situation. And his first idea was to play Marlon as an indulging, mango-eating, over indulging himself here in the jungle in this situation, and just play him sort of overweight and his uniform not really fitting properly, and just go with that whole kind of look. And Marlon did not want to do that. He just was unwilling to do that. So then Francis was really at a loss. What could he do then if he wouldn't do that? So the two of them sat down for days talking about what part he could play and how they could resolve the ending of this movie. And they at one point came up with this very theatrical, larger-than-life personage that you see just emerging from the darkness and the light, and you never really fully see him as a reality. He's much more of a sort of an archetypical, mythical figure. And that was sort of a new approach for Brando, because he was known for his great reality, the grittiness of his realness in his performances, so that he struggled with that too, and the two of them had a real head-to-head go there trying to resolve the ending of the film.
A lot of Marlon Brando's part was improvised. There's some really interesting footage in Hearts of Darkness of Brando improvising. Would you describe a little bit the process that he and Francis Coppola used to improvise the part?
Well, they would come up with some actual lines and some of the dialogue that Marlon was to say, but the way Marlon works is he has to find a reality, so he would then put those lines into kind of just a sort of free form improvising and talking as he went along through the part. So they had definite points that he was supposed to make, and he then kind of created around those points and kind of gives it that reality. Because one of the things he does, he, for instance, will like write a line on his hand or put it on a piece of tape on one of the props nearby, so that he sort of has to look for that line and sort of give it that little edge of struggle that, just like we have in our own conversation, I don't know exactly what line I'm going to say next, and it gives my voice a kind of edgy reality, because I'm sort of fishing for what the next line is going to be. And he does that. It's part of his technique to not learn his lines and just spit them out slickly, but to really just have to have that little edge of reaching for them.
It sounds from the footage you shot that one of the techniques that they'd used to improvise was that Francis Coppola would ask Marlon Brando questions off camera, and then Brando would have to respond to the questions, and the camera would be rolling as he responded.
Yes, that's right.
Why are we in Vietnam?
It's our time to grab this moment in history. It's our time to teach. Huh? I can't think of any more dialogue today.
Dennis Hopper played the part of a really drugged-out American journalist in Vietnam. When he was cast in this role, he already had the reputation for being genuinely drugged out and burned out. And there's some terrific footage in the documentary of him and Francis Coppola talking together and trying to like work out what the part's going to be. And Coppola wants to know how come he doesn't know his lines yet. Why did Coppola even bring on Dennis Hopper? And I'm a really big fan of Hopper's asking this question, but he was in such bad shape then. You know, you wonder, why would you ask for this kind of trouble?
Well, I don't think Francis actually realized he was in that kind of shape. He thought he was a really good actor, and he had a lot of admiration for him, and he was cast in a role, a Green Beret role, and when he really got out there, Francis realized there's no way that he could play this the Green Beret, and he had to then sort of invent a part for him, because he thought he was very talented and there must be some way to use his gifts. And so Francis has the great ability to make the part fit the actor rather than the other way around. If the actor comes and can't play the part as written, he rewrites the part, and he certainly did that in Dennis's case, and tried to somehow utilize the character that he was, because that was one of the issues in the Vietnam War, is the use of drugs and the availability of drugs. And in fact, there in the Philippines, because of where we were there in Asia, there were drugs available and cheaply, and things that aren't available just here in while everybody's home in Los Angeles, so that there was experimentation among the people who were out there. And Dennis, of course, was just really far out at that moment. In fact, he looks back at that period and is pretty astounded himself, I think.
Why did you say that to him in the scene? Who?
Something clever like that.
When he says, who are you? Why don't you say, who are you?
Because I haven't learned my lines yet.
I know, you've had them for 5 days.
The other thing I'd like to say is that...
These glasses,
I can't see anything through them. But like, you know, every crack represents a life I've saved. You know what I mean? They represent a life I've saved.
You're saying that all out in the scene.
I do, but you see, the director, you know, the director says, you don't know your lines. And then, like,
well,
you know,
if you know your lines, then you can forget them.
Oh,
you know more or less.
I see. But that's what I'm trying to do. Forget those lines.
No, but it's not fair to forget them if you never knew them.
During the making of Apocalypse Now, you sent your husband a telex, telling him he was becoming like Kurtz and creating his own Vietnam with his supply of wines and steaks and air conditioners. And you sent copies of this telex to the set designer, the cinematographer, and the production manager. Why did you do that? I mean, something must have really been working on you for you to not only telex Francis, but to telex the people who he worked with.
Well, at that moment, in my opinion, I was really concerned that the whole thing was going too far and had the potential of tipping over the edge. And that was just my response to the situation at that point in time. And now we're looking back at it, and so it doesn't seem so appropriate. But in the intensity of the moment, that was the moment where I just felt I had to speak out and give my opinion. And all throughout this project, it kept going, you know, closer and closer and closer to the edge, it seemed like. And in fact, I felt the forces and the pressure on Francis were so profound that I was very worried that he wouldn't be able to withstand all of those pressures. That was my one, you know, really deep and major concern, is that somehow it would just push him over the edge in some way. And in fact, he did collapse at one point and faint. And there was a moment where I was concerned, you know, that he might have a nervous breakdown or something. But he is a strong person, and after a couple of days, he was able to get his strength back and get his balance back and go on with the project and complete it. But there were some very scary moments there.
Eleanor Coppola shot the documentary footage on the making of Apocalypse Now, which is used in the movie Hearts of Darkness. It comes out on video Tuesday. Her journal, Notes on the Making of Apocalypse Now, has been published in a new edition by Limelight Editions. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up later on today's program, we'll hear about decisions announced by the U.S. Supreme Court today on historically black colleges and the meaning of Brown versus Board of Education when it's applied to them. Also, whether airports are public places and whether members of the Hare Krishna sect have a right to solicit funds at airports. We'll also hear about the money troubles that the Bill Clinton campaign is having, how the railroads were put back to work today, and the history of the Railway Labor Act of 1926 that made it possible. Also, the myth of two pains and the music of Sergio Mendes. That's coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Director Jonathan Kaplan began by making inexpensive genre pictures like Night Call Nurses and White Line Fever for the producer Roger Corman. Later, he graduated to more mainstream movies, including such well-received films as Heart Like a Wheel and The Accused. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Kaplan's latest, Unlawful Entry.
Apparently, Kaplan's gone back to making genre films again, only this genre doesn't have a name yet. Let's call it the indoor psycho film. You know what I'm talking about. See, there's this psycho, friendly, attractive, smiley, ingratiating. He or she inveigles himself or herself into your home and wins the trust and affection of your spouse. Pretty soon you suspect that the psycho is taking over your life, but only you know how right you are. That is, until it's almost too late. Oh, one other thing. The psycho has to die in the end, of course, but not once, always twice. You kill him or her. You walk away, preferably putting down your weapon. The music swells, pretending that the film is over, and then the monster rises suddenly behind you, bleeding and wearing a hideous grin. Am I giving anything away? Of course not. When I saw Unlawful Entry, every single member of the audience always seemed to know what was going to happen before it did, and they were always right. Kurt Russell plays Michael, a hustling businessman trying to open a new nightclub in downtown L.A. Madeline Stowe, an incompetent, pleasant-looking actress who somehow always gets cast as the raving beauty no man can resist, is his wife, Karen, a schoolteacher. One night, a thug breaks into their inexplicably lavish house and puts a knife to Karen's throat. The thug gets away, and when the police finally arrive, one of them, Pete Davis, played by Ray Liotta, seems extra friendly and helpful. The sure signs of a movie psycho. Officer Davis starts hanging around, helping with the new alarm system, slowly but surely trying to seduce Karen. Meanwhile, he's also trying to destroy Michael's nightclub business. And finally, Michael offers him $5,000 just to go away and leave them alone. Davis isn't buying.
Bribe Mikey. Call whatever you want, Pete. I need this deal.
Shh. You hear that? Used to work these hills. I knew this lady. She was out walking her little poodle. And a coyote comes charging out of the brush, snatches up the little poodle and takes off. All we ever found of that little doggie was its diamond-studded leash. You know, when Karen first met you, she actually thought you were different than her gambling father. It's very interesting how people follow patterns. See, she doesn't feel safe with you either, Michael. And Karen needs to feel protected from when those coyotes come charging out of the brush.
You listen to me. You stay away from her.
Now, was that scene better when it was more threatening in Cape Fear? Or did you like it better when it was more psychologically layered in Fatal Attraction? I think the best version was in Internal Affairs, which was almost exactly like this movie in every particular, only spookier and sexier and more twisted. But now we're becoming connoisseurs. Maybe your basic indoor psycho movie is better off without that scene at all. The Hand That Rocked the Cradle didn't have it, and neither did The Stepfather, and both of those were better than this one. Pacific Heights and Deception and Firstborn and A Kiss Before Dying were worse. As the psycho, Ray Liotta is at least as creepy as Rebecca De Mornay, and Kurt Russell is as solid as Michael Douglas, but not as fun to watch as Andy Garcia. Madeline Stowe is worse than everybody except Sean Young, but putting Sean Young in a psycho movie and having her play the victim, not the psycho, is at least an ironic touch. Okay, but look, let's keep it simple. If for some reason you require further exposure to the thrills of the indoor psycho genre, skip Unlawful Entry, head straight for your video store, and rent the granddaddy of them all. It's called Rosemary's Baby.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Shirley Horn was one of Miles Davis's favorite singers. Many jazz fans feel the same way. On the next Fresh Air, a concert and conversation with singer and pianist Shirley Horn. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.